Hi, this is Clay Boykin. This afternoon, my producer, Dennis Tardon, and I had the opportunity to visit with a dear friend of mine, Good John Bergman. I've known Good John since shortly after the Men's Fellowship Network launched in 2012, and he has been a dear friend and mentor to me through the years. Here's that conversation.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and welcome to the podcast In Search of the New Compassionate Male. I'm the producer, and I'm here with Clay, the founder.
Hi, Dennis. How you doing?
And our guest today, a new friend to mine, but an old friend to you, Clay, is Good John Bergman. Hello,
Good John. Good to be with you.
Good. Clay, tell us how you all met.
Oh, gosh, it's kind of funny. It was early on in the men's circle.
I think it was one of the first few meetings.
So it was very early on. 2012?
Yeah.
Okay, so it was 2012, and one night Good John walked in and introduced himself, and he said, "I'm Good John," and I stumble over his name. He says, "Just, you know, like Bad John, it's Good John." Okay, it's Good John. And he said, "I'm from Iceland." And I said, "You're from Iceland? Well, do you know so-and-so?" You know, like, "Oh, you're from Texas, you know so-and-so, right?" Well, the funny thing was, he said, "Oh, yes, she's one of my mother's best friends." And that's where our relationship began. That's how we met.
That's how small Iceland really is.
Good, John, what attracted you to the men's circle and this? When did you grow up in Iceland?
Yes.
So what were the gender dynamics of the family and the people that were around you as you were growing up? What years were those when you were a child?
Okay, so in 1980, Iceland elected the first woman president in the Western democracies. So there's always been this. And the feminist movement in Iceland, sure, that there's a more aggressive version of it, but mostly the feminist movement is we're all equal, right? That's just the feminism. There is not anything, you know, less than the equal rights of men and women. Period. You know, and so that's kind of the social environment I was brought up in. The family environment was different. I had a very successful entrepreneurial businessman for a father. I'm not going to go into the whole family history, but it didn't start out quite the way that most relationships start out. They started out being having an affair. He was married to another woman. And so they had an affair for 12 years, and I was born 3 years into the affair. He was 9 when we moved in together. So the male dynamic was missing mostly from my early childhood. So it's mostly my mother, my grandmother, my mother's brothers. Those were my, and when I look at role models in my life, I guess those two, my mother and grandmother, sit there right at the top for who I look to for guidance over the years.
Right. And so you were attracted in this, and this is where the men's circle, how often, Clay, have we heard stories like this, that this element of the divine masculine, or what we are looking for, which is this new archetype of the new compassionate male. How often have we heard that story in the men's circle?
Yeah, it's very common in one way or the other, whether there was, no father figure at home. And so when they looked up, say, well, what is it to be a man? It was, look at TV, look at the movies, and those are the role models out there.
Actually very interesting. So when I was in my early 20s, I worked for a period of time at a daycare center in Iceland. And I went to a conference about men in the care professions, teachers, nurses, you know, daycare workers, and so on. And there were relatively few. And one of the things they talked about was the effect on young boys that are brought up mostly by, you know, by women, their mothers, grandmothers, early teachers. A lot of people, a lot of kids don't see men in a caring teaching position until they enter middle school or high school. Up until then, it's all female staff. And so the question was, what happens to those boys that don't have a male role model? And the answer surprised me, because what they said was that it actually goes the opposite way, like you said, Clay, that they go to comic books, they go to movies, and so they see these hyper-masculine versions of what it means to be a man, and they assume that that's... And they also see how women behave, and they think also, I'm a man, so I should behave the exact opposite of that, right? So I should, when they do this, I need to be this different, because I'm not a woman, I'm a man, you know. And so I think, you know, it was interesting for me to get my father into my life when he was 9, and we became really good friends in my late teens and throughout my 20s and into my early 30s when he died. But initially, you know, in my teens and late teens, I was really searching for what it meant to be a man. And I went, you know, in both directions. I joke with a good John, bad John name combo, but I was really, you know, I was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for a while there. I was working at a daycare center during the week and teaching yoga weeknights. And then I was partying and getting into fights and all kinds of, you know, not so great stuff on the weekends. It was really two polar opposites, a battle within, for sure.
And that's the journey, right? I mean, we talk a lot about the shadow side and being able to accept both parts in order to be able to do. I mean, you were, from what I understand, you're a student of Ken Wilber, good John?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we talk about, Clay and I both studied spiral dynamics and a lot of the work that is happening. And one of the things about spiral dynamics is that we tend to, when we move up the spiral, is to deny those things that came before us. Oh no,
yeah, transcend and repress. Yeah,
that wasn't us. I can't possibly believe that I believe, but it is. It has to be an acceptance all the way through. That acceptance of both the light and the shadow in order to be able to come. Are you finding that?
Well, I mean, I really resonated with the idea of transcend and include in growth. Right, instead of transcend and repress, right? So I move up and I grow into something new. And instead of repressing and saying, oh, that was just stupid, what I was before, and it's all bad and all that, I really like the idea of including those elements. And quite frankly, you know, I've been staying at home and writing and doing music and all that for the last 10 years, but my primary obligation has been taking care of my kids. And so it's really interesting to find some of those dynamics that are very, very masculine in me that don't translate well into the caretaker, into the caretaker role. No, I mean, I'm serious about that, because let's take, for example, the masculine voice, right? So I raise my voice, and it sounds like I'm really, really angry. My wife raises her voice, and it just sounds like, okay, she's emphasizing something.
She's saying, pay attention.
Yeah. But she's not angry, but right? And so that's what I was raised with. Like, my mom would raise her voice. My grandmother would raise her voice to you know, hey, you know. When I do the same thing, it just sounds, you know, overwhelming and like I'm really, really angry, which I'm not, you know, and that and having to relearn that dynamic and say, okay, so what are my alternatives to that? Or how can I explain to my kids that when I do that, all I'm saying is, hey, pay attention. That's just one of many things where we're balancing these, masculine, feminine role models and male, female role models comes into play.
Mm-hmm. How fascinating. Good, John. How can you talk about how old are your children and what genders do they identify with?
Yeah, so my son is turning 18 this fall, and my daughter is she turned 12 this summer.
So how can you, without, we're not trying to probe so much into it, but just what I'd like to know is what you're learning about yourself from them. And from being interacting with them, and how are you nurturing them in ways that you would have loved to nurture or be nurtured?
Well, I think I try to provide the missing elements from my youth, of course. Part of why whenever we've come to a fork in the road after we moved here, which says either the kids go to more daycare and after school care and all that, or we find a way where I can stay at home still and be there for them. I always take that road. My professional career has just suffered immensely from mm-hmm. that. It's this idea that irrational idea, I think, that people have with, I'm going to have kids and it's not going to change my life. I'm just going to, it's nonsensical, right?
Right.
Because when people say things like, I remember in the New Age movement back in the day, I was very involved in that back in Iceland for a long time because of my parents. And that was one of the reasons why I came to Unity, because of the same speak and similarities. But I had a kind of a love-hate relationship with the New Age because of I got introduced to it when I was 16. So that's another issue. Having been, and when people say, yes, when people say things like, can't live your life for other people. You can. I mean, I think it's a worthwhile sacrifice. And people always chide me when I say sacrifice. Oh, you shouldn't sacrifice my life. I think it's actually a good thing. And it's done out of love and not out of just, shame or pure obligation or something like that.
How much the woman's journey that, and certainly in the United States, I mean, you look at Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi, raised her children before she ever even began her career. She is now the third in line for the presidency of the United States. So you are taking a role.
But it's always, my question then always becomes, when people say this, and it's like, who's going to take care of the kids? Right, so it's either going to be either one of the parents, or it's going to be society, or it's going to be somebody who's blind, and so on. And what I decided early on with my kids is I'm going to be there for my kids and I'm going to support them. And I think it was interesting. I told my wife that just before we met that I was about to throw in the towel and just go to a monastery. And that was going to be it for me. No more, because all it caused me was heartaches and headaches and all of that. And in some strange way, I got my wish when we moved here to Texas. Being at home, being a caretaker, having a lot of time to think, having a lot of, I spent years and years and years reading hundreds of books, being a seminar leader, being a workshop, doing all these magnificent things, right? Building this, to use the phrase from the Greek philosophers, building this memory palace in my mind, and then find myself using the kitchen and broom closet mostly when I'm staying at home, and it's just felt such a disuse of space. But then I thought, okay, well, now I have all this time, which I really don't, but I have time in my mind. I have space in my mind. And so I'll put that to good use. And I've written quite a few books in that period and done a lot of things that have helped me understand myself and everything. But I think that the biggest thing is I've learned the true meaning of the word love and of the word sacrifice. And that love is being there when you feel like you don't want to be there, and sacrifice is doing something to help another person grow and learn. My favorite definition of love comes from Scott Peck, and he talks about the willingness to give of your time, money, and energy for the benefit of somebody else. And that's truly been the journey for me, is to really grow into that sense of being, of lovingly sacrificing and reminding myself that this is always, every day, it's a choice. It's not something, I could get out of it any time if I wanted to, but every day I make the conscious choice to not only stay, but to really give and be there for the kids. And quarantine has made it all the more, But it's interesting, though. It was less of a change for me than anybody else in the family.
Did good, John, did you have a vision of what the American dream was when you came here? I'm also an immigrant. Yeah. I'm from Mexico. I came over here in 1952 when I was four. You're an immigrant from Iceland.
Yeah.
And became an American citizen like I did.
Yes.
Clay, you're a native, right?
Yes, my grandparents on my mother's side were from Sicily in southern Italy. So I'm one generation in.
So did you have an idea of what the American dream was, and has that evolved for you, good John?
Well, I encountered all kinds of culture shock after I moved here. And I did have an idea of what the American dream, and quite frankly, it's taken 10 years, but we have a house, we live in the suburbs, we have the two cars and the two kids and all that. And so that part of the American dream has stood up to scrutiny. I think Hollywood has done a great job of selling, the American dream and selling the idea that, come to America, anybody can make it in America and all of that. I found that, quote unquote, making it in America without any money or as an entrepreneur and all that. I tried a variety of different things using skill sets that I had acquired over the years. And so that part is still eludes me. getting any meaningful traction with my work, so that it starts making any kind of money or anything like that. Seeing my wife advance in her career, that has been part of the American dream. If I were to boil it down to two things that have stood out as jarring, is how much more religious Americans are than sold by Hollywood, and how the media and movies do a tremendous disservice by not portraying that accurately and by not bringing us into houses of worship everywhere and showing us not just who's going there, but what's being said and how it's being said and so on. I think that's a missing link, and I think I've been following religion reporters now since I became an interfaith minister for about 4 or 5 years. And they're not religious reporters. They report on religion. And I'm saddened to see how little of that material ever gets into, you know, the traditional media, how they've kind of said, okay, but religions, because it's such a big part of this society, that not reporting on it, not including more detailed information about it, is a tremendous disservice. So I really think that that part was missing for me. And the second thing is really, you know, how overly masculine the society is here, and how, you know, how, and again, that may be tied into religion, but it is, you know, of course, Iceland does not have an army, and we don't play American football. I think those two things do play a role in creating a kind of gender stereotype that, you know, for a lot of guys, it's hard to move from under. I see a lot of my son's kind of acquaintances and friends moving in that direction. I see how it's, you know, and so that kind of, those were the two things that I've had the hardest time with. And one of the reasons why I was attracted, so this is a long answer to your initial question, but one of the reasons why I got attracted to the Men's Fellowship Network, because I thought, oh, okay, here are guys that are at least willing to show up and maybe talk a little bit about their feelings and about their spiritual journey and about their hopes and dreams and fears and what it means to be a man and all those things. And to me, those were, again, coming from Iceland, those were like just guys in Iceland. Right. They were not like special group that would come together for that purpose. They were just like, oh, here are some guys that look and feel and sound a little bit like what most of my friends sounded like in Iceland, but I had to go to a special group to find that here, which was intriguing.
You know, I never really realized that contrast like that. I mean, the Men's Fellowship Network, you know, we say, well, we're counterintuitive about everything. You know, gatherings are not meetings. We're a network and not a group, and we don't call anybody out, all those. And I just thought that was the way we were going to differentiate ourselves, because that's what I needed at the time. I didn't need judgment. I needed acceptance. I needed to learn how to trust another man. And it was instinctual that it grew that way.
No, I mean, it's real. It's, and I see it with a lot of my European friends here as well. Mm-hmm. I see that there is the similar kind of difference there.
Do you see an evolution happening? Would we know it, good John, if it were happening, if we as men, Clay, of course, you began this project in search of the new compassionate male. And when I signed on, I totally bought into it, that whatever is going to be post-patriarchal, there's got to be something has to fill in. It can't just collapse. There has to be a role for men and whatever it is, the male. Clay, could you redefine that we're not talking about just men?
Oh, gosh, here? Yeah. Well, that's why I call it In Search of the New Compassionate Male and not New Compassionate Man or New Compassionate Men, because man has got, you know, connotation, meaning it's got this charge that can be negative, and shying away from using the word masculine in that title. The new compassionate male is inclusive. We all have the male energy, you know, whether our gender is male or female, we have that. And so my hope is in searching for this, and I really believe that this new compassionate male is really emerging as the new archetype, that everyone is included in that, regardless of gender. You know, it's, you know, biology is one thing, but the male spirit we're all included in that conversation.
I mean, it's interesting when you talk about that, because two things come to mind. One is I've been working with Charter for Compassion. I've been working on my little Harmony Interfaith Initiative here for a few years. And one of the things I like to do just to gain clarity is to define the words and terms that I'm working with so that, you know, I can easily explain what I mean, you know. So by compassion, you know, I've defined it as the ability to see things from a multitude of perspectives and then act accordingly, right? So I can put myself in your shoes, and then I can see how you feel and see what that feels like walking in your shoes. But that's not enough. That's just empathy, right? And then compassion is taking the extra step and doing something about it. And it's like, those are terrible shoes. I need to buy you a new pair of shoes, right? or something to that degree. And so compassion is this growth phenomenon, is the growth phenomenon of saying, you know, here, let me look at this from my child's perspective. Let me look at this from my spouse's perspective. Let me look at this from the perspective of people I work with, that I commune with, that I live around, and so on. So every increase in ability, and this takes more than just being around different people, it takes a lot of imagination. And that's why one of the things that Wilbur talks about, there's a moral growth coincides with intellectual ability or cognitive ability to really think and imagine. And so you find people, yes, who are very intellectual with low morals, but you rarely find people with very high morals who do not match that with some cognitive ability to you know, to really think through and imagine and see the nuances of other people's lives and be able to adjust and so on. And so when I think of, so, and then when I think male and female, a lot of people are talking, they say, okay, well, we need more women in you know, positions of power and all that. And Wilbur takes this a step further and he says, no, you know what? We need more men and women who are more compassionate, who have grown more, who have taken the extra step. It's not just about, and so, one of the great things, as you talked about being a caretaker, being a mother, being a stay-at-home father, being somebody who's there, is that you are, you know, if you want to do well, you have to put yourself in other people's shoes. And so I think what we need are more caretaking, compassionate people, men and women, in positions of leadership, and that eventually. And to answer your earlier question, I do think there is a trend happening towards that, but it is, you know, it is strewn with another Wilbur favorite of mine is the Darth Vader syndrome. So the more evolved something becomes, the more things can go wrong, right? And so, so more complex things become, the more things can go wrong. And so the more we grow, there are new problems that surface, new things that we have to take into account, new stumbling blocks that we encounter.
Yes. As it is, if we were to play a video game, you move to that next level. When you move to that next level, suddenly there are all kinds of new opportunities and challenges that we would have that did not occur at this level where we were. So it feels like as we go through our states and stages.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's new stuff to deal with every time, and new things that can go wrong, you know.
Clay, isn't that amazing? I love the way Good John talked about that and talked about the male and talked about the male, the male principle, and this that we're growing both in men and women. It's exactly what you've been talking about, what you've been working with throughout this movement.
It is. It's not a guy thing or a gal thing. It's both. It's a yes and. And one of the Carl Jung's term is, you know, holding the tension of opposites. You know, yeah, we've got these polarizing sides, but it's a higher level conversation than that. And you're right, good John, compassion is that level up there, that common ground that we can all aim towards, regardless, man, woman, however you define yourself.
And I love, good John, I love your thoughtfulness to go back to the definitions of what do we mean by these words. It's so easy to toss words around and then to think I know what I mean by that word, but have I really gone back and really worked at the root of what is it that I mean there?
A great friend of mine who is an Icelandic shaman who used to do sweat lodges together back in the 90s, he coined this term. He said the most common understanding is misunderstanding. And you know, that happens to be true. I mean, there's a language difference, of course, but there's also a connotation difference. You think you're using a word specifically, and you think you're very thoughtful in your use of words. But I did a lot of workshops and a lot of speaking back in the day. And one of the first things I always did was to say, okay, here's a term, stress. Let's define that term. Because when people, it's an umbrella concept, right? And so you think, okay, if I want to talk about it, we need to have a common ground perception of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so I start with that, with meditation, with yoga, with all the things I was talking about, positive thinking, all that. I said, okay, what does that mean? And then we went into the detail of that. And then as the conversation evolved, then at least we were somewhat, I mean, there was even misunderstanding in that arena, but we were somewhat talking about the same thing. Whereas if I would have started just saying, here's this, and then people have a totally different view of what that means, then we might as well be talking over each other or at each other, which is so common.
Yeah. Well, we even run in that on Monday nights. We come in and I'll put a term out there and we'll have a conversation. And I love, good John, how you're saying, let's define the term. You know, what is it? Because I see us, we'll get halfway through the evening and recognize, oh, we're not talking about the same thing here. Let's go back. But that's part of the process. That's part of the learning process, being in the circle, the ability to make that, you know, that mistake and get do-overs with grace.
So. Well, I mean, and the thing is, you can say here, so here's what we're going to talk about. Here's loosely what it means. Does anybody want to add to that understanding? And then that's added, and then you can move forward. You don't have to have a big discussion about it, about what it means, but you just have to have some common ground. Frame of reference. So, okay, so because that opens some doors in the memory palace for everybody.
Oh, yeah. I find it fascinating. How do you stay as a learner and keep your mind open, especially as an intellectual and as someone who has been out there and has done the kind of work that you are? We can fall into the trap of thinking that we know it and then stop learning. And I know that that's when I get into the trap. When I, the beginning, I think I know it and I think I've got it. That's when I'm in the trap. I go from being a learner to trying to be a teacher, and a teacher is not my role. My role is to be a deep learner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's hard. I've been a teacher most of my life, and that role comes easily to me, and I have an easy time of taking, you know, abstract concepts and bringing them down without losing their meaning and so on.
Yes.
I did write about this in my latest book. There's a memoir called Spiritual in My Own Way. And I went really deep with Wilbur for about 7 years. I first listened to an interview with him, and then the 10 CD interview. And then I in 7 years, I read most of his books, which he advised against. And
I was just going to say, oh my goodness.
That was painful.
Well, but it was tremendous intellectual stimulation, the kind I've never really experienced before. And the great thing is that I found myself not just following along with it, but really understanding it at a deep level, being able to converse about it too with other people and so on. However, near the end of that 7 year, period, I found myself, dealing with something that I'd never experienced before in my life, which was a sense of intellectual pride. Because I'd never been able to really discuss in depth things with other people. And then I found myself not just being able to hold my own, but really being able to one up people in understanding and use of big words and stuff.
Yes.
It just, whenever I find myself, and there I simply disengaged from Wilbur for a little bit, and then came back to it with fresh eyes. Back into 2016, when I entered the interfaith, domain, and that's a whole other discussion and concept. Even just the word interfaith means so many different things to different people. Mm-hmm. But what spurred me on was curiosity. So I guess my answer to your question is that when I find myself, and this has only happened rarely, but it has happened, when I find myself with this intellectual pride where I think I've got this, I know this, I usually just open up a new avenue of investigation, right? So instead of keep going deeper into this, I say, back then I thought, okay, now let me investigate what the religions of the world have really been saying, and what's the difference between scripture and lived religion, which is a tremendous difference, and having been around people who, practice their faith and then what the faith says. There's a complementary aspect, but there's also differences. So even just you think like, okay, I'll read about these, I'll read these scriptures, which I've read most of the scriptures now. And you think, okay, now I know what that is. But then you go and talk to somebody who is Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or Sufi or Native American and so on, and you realize, there's a difference between the knowledge base and the application and the dogma and the application. And so being able to go in that direction, I think, and having that, hopefully that curiosity about what it is to be human. I mean, I did a really lousy job of being human for a while in my life. And so I've been trying to do better, but it's tough. And so, having that compassion, that empathy, and also understanding the traps along the way. I think one of the things too is having been a deep student of yoga, that was the other thing that where I really went deep with yoga philosophy. And my teacher for now 23 years, Yogi Shanti Desai, he spurred me on with that, and I was. He only ever complimented me with, "You ask very good questions," and then I realized, in order to be able to ask good questions, you have to have a certain amount of comprehension, because I would be teaching him, I say, "Any questions?" And when there was little comprehension, there were no questions. As soon as comprehension increased, you got more questions, right? You had more and more questions, and so. So that, I think, was also the idea that in yoga philosophy, that there's this idea that in the practice of yoga, finding inner peace, stillness, and so on, you get these toys along the way for distraction. It's like, being a parent, your kid keeps nagging you and you go like, "Here, play with this for a while. Let's see how..." And And one of those toys for the spiritual aspirant is the intellect. Mm. Is you can get lost in intellectual, self gratification. You can say where you really go deep. And sadly, a lot of people use that to downplay intellectualism as part of spirituality, which I don't agree with. I think it's a very important part, but it's a transcend and include, not the beginning and end of everything. It's not simply going deeper and deeper and deeper into words and concepts and all that, because eventually what is real is what's always present and never changes, and words and thoughts and images certainly change. So that's not it. That's not the end.
Brilliant. I love. So today in 2020, here we're in the middle of COVID, and we're in the middle. What kinds of things are on your mind? What kinds of ideas are burbling forth as you're going? What's impelling you? What kind of inklings are coming that are exciting or interesting you?
Well, I don't know if they're exciting, but what I've been obsessed with for the last few years is how can we better get along as people, and why is division taking such a deep why is it sprouting such deep roots in people's psyches, and and I think because of the things that I fear for my kids' future, if I take that approach, is global warming and division. Mm-hmm. Those are the two major things that I find. And so I've been obsessed with these ideas of how can we better come together. And I found that in Northern Ireland peace process, there was a man called Padraig O'Malley. Butchering his name, of course, but he's an Irishman, and he said something very interesting that I've since expanded upon and used in a lot of my work and in a book I've written and an online workshop I've done quite a few times. It's this idea of the two personas that we have. And this is not like we only have two personas and that's it. It's just it's an expression to kind make a distinction between a couple of different things in our psyche. And what he says is there's a difference between the human persona and the ideological persona, right? And so when we as people emphasize the ideological persona above the human persona. That is, we talk about others by their intellectual or belief labels versus about being equally human. Then we open up the possibility of violence, of disadvantaging people, and so on. So, what I got from that is that we have to find more and more ways of emphasizing and through compassion, through interactions, through imagination, emphasizing our shared humanity, that's the common ground that can reduce division. Whereas the more we emphasize our differences, ideological belief differences, political differences, and so on, and the more we talk about each other in those terms, as a liberal, as a conservative, as a Christian, as a Muslim, as something, right? The more we define those and differentiate between those and then make those into curse words mm-hmm. in the way that we say them, right? The more we open up the doors to dehumanizing others, and that allows us to see them as less than us. And we really see this, like when somebody, when people gloat over the misfortunes of others who believe differently than they do, which I've seen happen in just the recent days.
I'm guilty.
Yeah.
Guilty.
And so when you say, aha, and all of that, that is taking us as humanity in my opinion, in the wrong direction. I think the more I study the world's religions, the more I see that, their aspirations for being good, their aspirations for creating harmony and cohabitation, those are aspirations that need to take a more global stage, but it's hard because compassion begins in your inner circle, right? And so your ability to have compassion begins at home and it expands to your community and so on and so forth. And you can't go from selfish to world-centric in one step. Right? It's not, you're selfish. If I just say, be more world-centric, that's going to change you. No. Growth is non-linear. Growth is difficult. Growth is earned. Growth is, and you have to run into your own limitations before you grow. And if you don't run into those limitations, then you have no incentive to grow, right? So it's kind of a double-edged sword here, is that I really am interested in emphasizing shared humanity, forgiveness, harmonious living, self-examination before condemning others. It's just stuff from the scriptures, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to emphasize that, but I also understand that change in both individual and societal does not happen until that individual or society really runs into the limitations of the way things are being done. And that is all often painful, and reality of being human is, you don't change behavior until it's painful enough to keep on doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I can be encouraged by the turmoil that's happening, and another way it can go either way, right? The outcome is not guaranteed just because there's turmoil, right?
That's also, it makes it a feature. With the outcome not being guaranteed, that means that we get an opportunity to be able to go for it. We're in this. We're in the middle of the story without knowing what the ending is going to be. I mean, it's going to take all our effort. Let's go for it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that's what that keeps me going, is this just simple idea. Like, I'll tell you a story. When I was younger, I smoked a lot, and then I quit smoking, and then I had success with quitting smoking, so I made a course about smoking cessation. And that caught the eye of public health authorities in Iceland, and they contracted me to go talk to kids in schools about tobacco prevention. Now, if you've never had the experience of being unwanted, walk into a classroom full of 15-year-olds and say, "Oh, this guy's going to talk to you about tobacco prevention." I mean, the audible sighs, the collapsing on the table, the hoodies and all that. And so I did that for several years, and it was, if I would have just gone off of the reactions I got from my audience, I would have quit. It would have been dispiriting completely. But I realized that there was a deeper thing, right? That one person did not smoke, that could save or extend a life potentially. And and reduce suffering and all that. And so I just went forth with the idea of I'm the sower of seeds. I'm not the person who stays behind and makes sure that those seeds are nurtured and that they'll grow and so on. But if no seeds are being sowed, then nothing will happen. Right? So that helped me tremendously going forward when I was talking about difficult topics or when I was, you know, contracted to go into companies to talk about stress management and so on. And people were like, oh, this guy, you know, during lunch, can I have my lunch break, please? Right. But then I thought to myself, you know what, if I sow a seed today, if I sow one seed, you don't know when it's going to, you know, germinate, what's going to happen.
So true.
And so taking that approach and not being attached to the outcome, I think is what has kept me going and what keeps me going even now, because I really do want to sow some of these seeds, but the outcome is you know, very unsure. And it really feels like I'm barking up the wrong tree these days with these talks about shared humanity and harmony and everything. And people are so self-righteous in their camps that, you know, that their truth is the absolute truth. And there's no and there's no common ground or middle ground or anything. And the ideologies just get ever more solidified and you know, the butting of heads are becoming more and more difficult. So people, even the person who comes in and say, hey, well, why don't we listen to so-and-so? And they go like, listen to that person? And then they just spout all the worst things mm-hmm. that could possibly be true about that person. And you're going like, and then I'm the bad guy for suggesting that, you know,
right.
forgiveness and common ground and all that. So, you know, sadly, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I think it's important for all of us who are interested in compassion and healing and forgiveness and, you know, creating safe space and all these things to be ready on the sidelines, to come in when people are ready, when people have had enough, when the pain has become overwhelming to a point where they go like, you know what, I'm ready for something new. I'm ready for a new approach here. And I think that, you know, having the solutions, having the men's circles somewhere to go to and so on, I think it's very important.
You know, good John, I have to say that, you know, you've authored over 20 books now. You're probably at 25 or so. And your inspiration to me over the past years is in helping me get my book out and coaching me and nudging me along. I wouldn't be sitting here had you not done that. So I want to say thank you for that. And the other thing is,
I want to say thank you for that too, because I got it because of that. So these are your generations. These are your
seeds,
ripples in the pond that you're seeing, that these are the fruits that come from the work that you're doing.
That's right. And so I want to say thank you for that. You're a tremendous mentor, and not to put you on the spot, but if somebody wanted to contact you, how would they do that?
Well, I have a website, goodjohnbergman.com. And so they can, and there's a contact form there. People can contact me there. And I'm on Facebook, and I'm on G. Bergman on Facebook and Good John Bergman on Twitter and all that. I've been pretty dormant on those media this summer, but I'll be getting back into it in the fall. So thank you.
And I want to thank you. Good John, for spending this time with us. I love leaving a conversation at a higher level of understanding of myself than when I entered it. And you have certainly provided the space for that to happen. Thank you so much. And Clay, thank you for arranging this and letting me be part of the search of the new compassionate male. See you next time.